We cannot think of perception without thinking also of perceiving some object, nor of the act of hearing without coupling some sound with it. There is no hearing without sound, no sense perception without its object. Therefore we find again that the two cannot be imagined save as one, that sight, and the thing seen are two sides of a single coin, that touch and a thing touched are the subjective and objective halves of a unity. When the scientific principle of relativity says that the observer is part of his observation, this means that the person who has experience of anything is part of his experience. We may carry this further and now say that it means that the thought is part of the thing thought of. If we ponder well upon this statement, we shall see that the mental factor is inseparable from every object known. And if we ponder deeper, we shall find that the two are really one. We cannot hold existence and the perception of existence apart from each other, and so we are forced to form the conclusion that the two are not two in reality but indissolubly one. The thing and the sensation of the thing live in fundamental and inseparable union. Thus there is nothing else but awareness. Ask yourself whether that statement will explain all your experience, and you will find that it will do so quite adequately. Try, on the other hand, to discover whether the theory of the materialists will explain your experience of the world. The theory that there is nothing else but independently existent physical things, and you will find that it does not and cannot explain the existence of thoughts and feelings. For if you believe that you can put something material into a test tube, you cannot do the same with thought. It must therefore be emphatically repeated that a percept is not a mere copy of something external. It is primal and not secondary. This should not be overlooked, because it is a key to correct understanding of mentalism, which is the doctrine that all things are mental things. We see that the notion of a pen existing independently of the mind to which it is present is a pure fiction. The percept of the pen is nothing less than the pen itself. That any other pen exists separately and materially is utterly beyond our range of possible knowledge and must therefore be ignored if we are to deal with scientifically ascertained facts rather than uncertain assumptions. The pen is a construct in consciousness. Its being is being known. There are not two pens, a material one and a mental copy of it. There is only one. The image which is immediately before consciousness is the pen itself. It is so vivid, so perfect and so convincingly stamped with the characteristic of objectivity that we do not stop with merely seeing it, we go on to infer that it is nothing less than the independent pen itself and refuse to believe otherwise. Yet the pen which is known by the senses is none other than the percept which is known by the mind. The magic of the mind. But we must now face an objection. Here am I with direct experience of a pen which lies outside me in space, separate from me, which I can pick up and grasp in my hand, finding it to be solid, weighty and hard. How then can you expect me to believe that it is merely an idea in my mind? To this the reply is that this doctrine must not be misunderstood to mean that it is asserted that the pen is not directly present to our vision. It most emphatically is present. Its very immediacy disarms us. We have got to grasp this truth that the perceived pen is not less rounded and weighty and colored and useful than the supposedly existent material pen, despite the fact that the former is a mental construct. In the previous two chapters we have seen that the mind is involved in all our experience of the world, and we have found that sensation, so far from being a purely passive and receptive process, is creative and even projective. But we are so enamored of the sensations of solidity which we receive from the things around us, and so deceived by the sensations of distance and position which we receive from their relations to each other and to our eyes, that we habitually underrate the tremendously suggestive and creative force of mind. We are almost totally ignorant of the proven and provable fact that mental images can assume size, shape, length, height, breadth, solidity, relief, perspective, weight, color and other qualities that we usually associate with external objects. They can provide all these sensations with perfect vividness and with all the actuality of ordinary experience. And yet they remain nothing more than ideas. Thus mental experiences are the visible things that we take to be outside us. The thing itself is admittedly existent, but the character of the thing is what we have now found out, and we have found it to be quite other than it is commonly thought to be. Those who would declare there are two separate facts, the fact of perception and the fact of an external material object, have made a false analysis of sensation. The oneness of both idea and object is a discovery to which the subtle thinking of the ancients and the sharp observation of the moderns inescapably lead, but it emerges only after the hardest and most rigorous reflection. Once this point is grasped, then one may say to himself, I am aware of my awareness of this thing, and he will then perceive that he cannot strip the second awareness from the thing in itself. They constitute an indivisible entity. Those who want to divide the fact, the thing known, into a percept of it on one hand and its material substantiality on the other, who make perception a mental act and substantiality a non-mental thing, who posit mind against matter, fall into a grievous fallacy. What we know is an idea, what we perceive is not a discovery but a mental construction. Those who deny this put themselves in the predicament of explaining away the inexplicable. Comes a further objection, do you mean to tell me, cavils the skeptic, that the abstract objects of my imagination, the phantasmagoria of my dreams, the pictures of my reveries and the phantom creations of my fancy are as real, are as existent and are as substantial as the 20-ton locomotive engine which draws yonder train of coaches? Do you mean to say that this engine is nothing more than a thought in my brain like these other fanciful thoughts? If that be so, why is it I cannot think such an engine into immediate existence, think as hard as I may, or think such a train into existence and step into the train and be driven away? The contrast between a supposed train and a real train is so strong as to make the suggestion that they are in any way similar quite absurd. There is the real train standing clearly and distinctly before me, I can confidently step into it, I can hear its powerful engine roar and puff, but I cannot see my imaginary train so solidly before me nor can I get anywhere in it except in self-delusion. Therefore I cannot accept your doctrine of mentalism. There is a trick in it somewhere, a snare or a pitfall. The perceived train is most useful to me, but the imaginary one is useless. It is utterly ridiculous for anyone to tell me that both stand on the same footing. Let it first be noted that what the critic cannot do has been done by others, that is find in waking fancies a reality and a vividness that make them completely present to the mind's eye. Great poets have done this, artists of genius have done this, celebrated mystics have done this and separated lovers have done this. They have found amid the scenes of their imagined surroundings and among their imagined faces a perfect sense of actuality. They did not at the time disbelieve in the real presence of the objects and persons thought of. There are indeed two conditions of the human mind which have been experienced by most persons and in which we find extraordinary illustrations of the possibility of doing part of what our critic cannot do. And they are when we are plunged in profound reverie and when we are plunged in profound dream. In these states the contrasts, between the perceived world and the imagined world, a contrast which is admittedly felt at normal times by ordinary people, is spontaneously suspended. We may enter trains during these rapt the magic of the mind states and be driven away in them and not for one moment shall we feel that they are not real trains and that our journey is not a real journey. On the contrary, we possess at the time a complete belief in the reality, solidity and existence of our ever reborn and dreamborn universe. Were we to live mostly in such conditions they would certainly be more real to us than would seem any temporary lapse into full waking life that might occur. Indeed, we would then attach a reality to them and deny it to the waking world. It is therefore unjustifiable to assert that because material things are so vividly and distinctly seen, whereas mental images are comparatively dim and vague, therefore the former cannot belong to the same class as the latter, cannot also be mental themselves. For it is here not a question of the manner in which a perception originates but of whether it is or is not mental. But our critic will object that this is a perverse and not a proper answer to his criticism. It is certainly not intended to be a full answer, for it is offered only as illustration and not as proof. If it vindicates nothing, it hints at many of the mysterious possibilities whereby the mind can fabricate reality. It is intended to warn him not to dogmatize too quickly about what or what not the mind can do. The full answer to our critic cannot be given here because it involves an explanation of the final secret of human personality, a revealment which falls into its natural place in the second and last volume of this work, which is yet to be written. And what the mystic apprehends with dreamlike vagueness about this secret the philosopher determines with amazing precision. Suffice it to say that per critic is right in making the latter part of his objection, for it is not contended by the hidden teaching that the individual mind, the ego, of any man can create his familiar world at its sweet will. Within this limit, the criticism shall find some answer in the present and the following chapter. The riddle of sensations. The further question will be asked by the critic, what then is the real nature of the independent objects which cause these thoughts to be presented? You tell us that what we see are only thoughts. Admitting this point, there is still a question which troubles us and which all this demonstration has completely if not cleverly avoided. Even if it be admitted that we know only the thoughts of things, there are still the things which seem to make the impressions on our sense instruments and so bring these thoughts ultimately into existence. If what we perceive is only a thought felt to be external, what becomes of the object which gives rise to this thought? Surely you would not ask us to identify the real thing with the mere thought of it? Surely that which causes the mental image to arise is not the same as the image itself? We may discredit the testimony of the senses, but we are unable to discard it. Nor is this all. You have passed over in complete silence the process whereby a sensation is born out of the vibrations in the brain. How is such a thought created? You have told us how the thing thought of is produced, but not how a thought itself comes into being. What is the independent object? How does the brain communicate with the mind? Certainly these two questions may now properly be asked, for they have not been explained so far. But can the existence of anything rightly come under consideration until what it is that is known to exist has been made clear? Yet this in turn depends on how we come to know it. Therefore it will be easy to see clearly the answer to the first question when we have learnt the answer to the second one. We shall therefore begin with the latter. Let us begin by noting that each sense experience is a twofold fact, percent. First, the physiological impressions experienced by the body, and second, the consciousness of these impressions. This consciousness may be termed the perception of the object. The combination of these two factors, physical impression on eye, ear, etc., and conscious thought constitutes our perception of it. Hence when we smell a rose we coordinate a state of mind with a state of physical disturbance. But how can the latter resolve into the former? How can mind take in what is non-mental? A physical disturbance is the very antithesis of a mental one. Where is the medium, the connecting link, which can bridge the striking gap between both these opposites? Here is a doubt which may legitimately be raised, a question which demands a direct answer. How does mind make the miraculous leap from a physical to a non-physical immaterial entity like sensation? How can mind testify to the existence of anything outside itself? Nobody has ever been conscious of the mind taking Tfi's distinct step of attending to and interpreting the activity in the grey matter of their brain. To say that we are never aware of the process whereby a sensation is born, and to say that the nerve vibration is converted into unconscious thought, is to take a leap in the dark and to land on entirely different territory. To make the process a subconscious one does not solve the difficulty, for it still remains a mental process. We come to a sudden full stop when we come to the magic of the mind, the molecular change m the brain. There the continuity ends. Consciousness makes an abrupt appearance at the other side of the chasm, and we do not know how to unite two such totally different orders of existence together. How can physiology bring the two ends together? The answer is that it does not bring them together. It leaves them precisely where they are. It bridges the chasm by using the word somehow, by assuming that the ends are somehow united. It accepts the chasm and then assumes that it is not a chasm. When, therefore, the science of physiology says that the gap is somehow closed, although it is quite unable to say how it is closed, it is indulging in a play of speculative fancy, not in a discovery of ascertained and verified fact. The leap it makes is not natural but arbitrary. Thus we return to the troubling question, how is it possible to relate mind which is immaterial to the brain which is material? Physiology confesses that the clearance of this gap between a wave-like movement in nerves tough and a conscious movement whole thought is incomprehensible to it, although it has tried to advance various hypotheses and guesses. None of these have been able to secure wide agreement. Nobody has ever adequately explained the facts of psychology by the phenomena of physiology. All such efforts have failed because they failed to understand the connection between mind and matter. Those who complacently assert that the crowning function of the nervous system is to produce thought beneath the bony rind of the skull assert a miracle more marvelous than any. Let them take up a measuring rod and mark the distance between one idea and another, between one conscious thought and another. They cannot do it, for nobody knows where the mind begins or ends. Is it not foolish to imply that in nodding their visible heads men nod their invisible minds at the same time? For under no conceivable circumstances can the mind be seen to reside in the head. Yet materialists accept unthinkingly the vague belief which regards the mind in the same way as it regards material objects. Nobody can bring an immaterial presence like mind together with a material place like the head, for there is no point and no surface in mind to meet any point or surface in the head. Yet they still talk as though mind were definitely located at the brain terminals of the sensory nerves. For the sake of convenience in common talk we may, perhaps must, continue to speak of the mind as though it were in one's head, but for philosophic purposes it is reprehensible to do so. Perception is a mental process, that is thought, and reason demands that the thought be referred to some subject to which it occurs, to some consciousness whereto the process happens. We must not therefore mistake the movements of material molecules in the fleshly brain for conscious thoughts. Those who cannot grasp the difference between both can never grasp the meaning of sensation, which is the most elementary fact of psychology. And the first steps in psychology are inescapable steps in philosophy. No microscope has ever discovered consciousness, and no opening of the skull has ever done it either. It is not observable. It must be treated for what it is, a separate and distinct fact. To treat the physical brain as identical with full consciousness is to deal in pure fancy. The attempt to explain perception away as being merely a matter of nervous functioning is nothing less than to beg the question. When the physiologist follows a sensation through its entire course from surface of the body to center of the brain, what has he really done? He has followed it in his own mind. He has performed an act of consciousness. It does not lose its mental character because he chooses to affix the name of nerve change to its corresponding physical vibration. His difficulty is that he cannot actively take a percept apart and yet keep it in full consciousness. It can be divided only theoretically. It is an entity, and now beyond any possibility of practical analysis. The dissecting knife can expose the nervous substance of the brain to sight, but it cannot expose a thought, an idea, a fancy or a memory image. The chasm between both seems quite unbridgeable. Here physiological science must frankly stop, bewildered and dumbfounded, for it is totally unable to explain satisfactorily this sudden and startling leap from unconsciousness to consciousness. Despite the best efforts of the best thinkers of modernity, physiology has failed to solve the following problem satisfactorily: what is the connection between the human mind within and the material universe without? What is the nature of the intercourse between thought and thing? Herbert Spencer, for example, who tried to interpret science to the 19th century world, who wrote scornfully of the philosophical attempt to reduce knowledge of things to knowledge of thoughts, had to confess that how the material affects the mental and how the mental affects the material are mysteries which it is impossible to fathom. For the fact of consciousness is a primary one, and it is the most mysterious fact in all human existence. No movement of material molecules can directly explain it, as nothing non-conscious can adequately account for it. We do not know that molecules possess the power to reflect upon their own nature. Mental experience, the magic of the mind, is and has ever been the supreme enigma set in the midst of a seemingly non-mental world. To confine consciousness to its events or to its contents, as is so often done, does not help to explain its own existence, but merely evades the issue. Science has succeeded admirably in telling us what mind does and how it behaves, but it has so far failed to tell us what it is. Mind is the recalcitrant entity which refuses to be disintegrated into anything else. Therefore we must keep on asking, how is it that a physiological process is converted into a mental one? For mind is both mysterious and unique. Nobody seems to know what it is, although everybody guesses. This we do know, however, that there is nothing else like it in the universe. Physiology has well considered and has long considered this problem, but has given it up as insoluble and inscrutable. The hiatus is utterly insurmountable. And such it must remain forever unless and until we recognize two simple yet subtle points which help to solve this problem, and with it the whole train of foolish questions that drag after it. The physiologist has not noticed these two points for the simple reason that such recognition would take him beyond the limits of his special science. If he is to remain a physiologist and nothing more, he must pay the heavy price of narrow specialism, expertness within those boundaries but ignorance outside them. If, however, he is willing to pursue his inquiry farther, then he must turn psychologist. There is no other direction to which he may turn for light. For the psychological standpoint is a beginning of the still higher philosophical standpoint. These two points are, first, the ultimate order in which the details of our becoming aware of objects follow each other and fall into their proper places. Second, what it is that the mind can really know. When the answers to these are both forthcoming, the answer to the great problem which stands at the end of the physiologist's road will reveal itself of its own accord. The first point bids us find out at which precise and crucial moment we actually become conscious of the objects around us. We then remember that according to physiology, during the whole passage of the impression from nerve ending to brain center, there is no moment that leaps into awareness of it, there is no fraction of a second of consciousness of the independent thing supposed to be outside and supposed to be reported. Only after it has reached its terminus, only as a subsequent act, does the striking contrast of the percept arise. S. We think of an object, and then mind, curious to know how the thought has arisen, tries to get behind it, with the consequence that the sensory side of the science of physiology gradually comes into being. The physiologist then slowly ascertains bit by bit the whole sensory process until he gets back to the thought again. He reveals nothing about the perception as a moment when thought flashes into their mind, when he reveals the way in which the object makes an impression on the sense instrument, or the way in which this impression is carried to the brain. For all these things imply the primacy of consciousness, whose presence is not explained by noting the things of which we are conscious, but is only described. The physiologist is like a man who can construct a violin and explain the laws of sound, but who cannot produce or explain the music itself. He does not realize that all his descriptions, which purport to account for the existence of his consciousness of an object, are descriptions of what occurs after the consciousness of it has already arisen. He does not perceive that his explanations of the action of nerve and brain processes, which are the result of interaction between the body and an object, are catalogues of occurrences which appear subsequent to consciousness of the object. Therefore his attempts to explain awareness explain everything but the percept itself, a fact which he unconsciously accepts when confessing that there is an inexplicable gap in the entire series of events. Now pose yourself the question. How do I first know that anything exists at all? And you will have to reply that you know or become aware of anything primarily through the mind and only secondarily through the senses. This is proved by the phenomenon of mind wandering and distracted attention described in the early part of the previous chapter. The brick wall that confronts you may remain outside the threshold of your consciousness so long as you persist in profound and attentive reflection upon a bygone experience or an immediate problem. This does not mean that the eyes have not performed their duties. On the contrary, the image of the wall will be found perfectly registered on the retina. Nor does it mean that the optic nerve has not performed its task of vibrating a message to the brain, nor that the cortical center in the brain has not received the message. All this has been done, the sense impressions have been made and the excitations have arisen in the brain. Why then does the wall remain unseen? because all these have been unattended to by the mind, because they have not been taken up into consciousness, because, to put it briefly, we can experience only what the mind experiences. When therefore you say that you have become aware the magic of the mind of a wall before you, what you really mean is that you have become aware of the percept of a wall, that is of the idea of a wall as an object of consciousness. Moreover, this same theorem was demonstrated in the examination of illusions and hallucinations likewise recorded in the previous chapter. When we put on a pair of spectacles for the first time we become quite conscious of their presence on the face. But after a while the glazed circles before our eyes and the pressure on our nose fade off from our awareness and we finish by becoming completely oblivious of both presence and pressure of the spectacles. The nerve endings in the skin, that is touch, tell us that they are there. The nerve endings in the eyes, that is sight, likewise report their existence. Yet we habitually fail to notice these impressions. Perception of the spectacles disappears from the mind and their existence with it. Why? Because the thought of the spectacles comes first and when we cease to think of them, being engrossed with other matters, the perception of the spectacles ceases also. Because the external aspect of the spectacles is only a projection of the internal idea. A thing cannot exist for us when there is no thought of it first. This is our experimental proof. Every event and every object is an event which must first be perceived and an object which must first be recognized. But perception and recognition are states of consciousness, ideas. Their dependence is on mind. Can any man be competent to know what apostrophe solidity is apart from first becoming aware of it? Can a thing come before the mind unperceived? Can it be known at all unless a knowing mind is apprehended along with it? Can there be any sort of cognition of something solid without the mental principle initially entering into it? We do not know and we cannot know any object apart from knowing the idea of it. The birth of awareness begins first. We have to get firm hold of this fact, that we are not first aware of a pen or a pageant but only of our sensations of them. We must make this distinction as clear to our experience as it is self-evident to our reason after we have analytically inquired into the process of our knowledge of external things. We become aware of thoughts, images, representations of things, not the things themselves. We feel sensations, touch them, smell them and taste them. Those who deem this impossible know neither psychology is science nor philosophy is interpretation of science. We know that things exist only because we originally know them mentally. Mind is the final ground of them. The thought of the thing comes first and must come first if we are to know it at all. Therefore, consciousness must arise before anything else, even before the whole sensory process operates. To sum up, the analysis of perception which physiology offers us is the result of direct observation. But nobody has ever seen the external object before it has passed into perception. This is irrefutable, for the seeing of it presupposes the perception of it. Therefore the object is brought into the field of notice for the first time with the perception of it and not before. Thus the analytic series which physiology originally offered us turns out to be incorrect from the higher standpoint of psychology, which makes the birth of the thought the first item in this series. Although quite correct from its own, were physiology to rise to philosophy it would be forced to revise its own analysis and offer a less fallible one. For physiology has fallen into this error because it insists on regarding the body as that which is alone real and enduring in comparison with thought, which it regards as ephemeral and illusory. The physiologist's gap appears only whilst he begins the series in the wrong order. Let him reverse it and put his idea, which he has put last, at the beginning where it ought to be, and then the gap will vanish. Consciousness is the inaugural fact of all our knowledge of the object without. Until it comes into operation we cannot even conceive that such an object exists. Yet after it comes into operation we do not even grant this simple primary condition. We perceive the object because we think it, we do not think the object because we perceive it. This truth is not one of those which man can make his own by merely glancing around. He can comprehend it only after hard thinking and relentless inquiry. It was earlier mentioned that there were two points which would help to bridge the gap between brain and mind. The first has now been explained and the second will now be explained. What is it that the mind does really know? There exist various theories of knowledge which are technically termed the double aspect theory, interactionism, psychophysical parallelism, the emergent theory, etc., but they all fail to meet different objections adequately.